From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life. Healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton.
Our first guest this morning is Chan Julie Wong. She has written a memoir called Beautiful Country. She writes about how she and her parents fled political and cultural persecution in China, how she was a seven-year-old when she came to this country with no English, how she survived as an undocumented immigrant in America now that she is a Yale Law School graduate and has written this book. She shares a very interesting story.
And then local health and yoga practitioner with a twist, Lauren Locke, will join the show to talk about how she combines her practice with saving animals at Sage Mountain Sanctuary, where they provide shelter and advocacy for rescued farm animals.
And finally, Bill Eddy, who is the co-founder of the High Conflict Institute. He's also the author of a new book, Calming Upset People with EAR, how statements showing empathy, attention, and respect can quickly diffuse a conflict. Sometimes more easily said than done, right, Pete? But it's helpful. You know, when we're all dealing with someone who's very upset, possibly they're angry with you or someone else, or they're sad, feeling helpless or frightened. This all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Oh, a couple of weeks ago, I taped an interview with a fascinating woman, Chan Julie Wong. She has written a memoir called Beautiful Country. She writes about how she and her parents fled political and cultural persecution in China, what it has been like for her to be an undocumented immigrant growing up in this country, first as a seven-year-old with no English, and how she not only prospered but succeeded in, well, by all terms, in a very successful way, and made it. She's now a Yale Law School graduate, and she has written a book to tell her riveting story. We hope you enjoy this conversation. Chan Julie Wong, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
We'll start off with the great news. Your book was recently released, and it is already top on New York Times bestseller list. Congratulations. Why do you think that your message is so appealing? So many people want to read about it.
Yeah, honestly, I am as shocked as the next person, but I can only guess that the universality of childhood and the human condition is more powerful than any of us anticipates on a day-to-day level.
You have gotten to this place that most of us can't even imagine, graduating from Yale Law School and so accomplished in your professional life. And, you know, it was the resilience of coming here as an undocumented person, being raised in poverty. That's the question. Is it the resilience that you created? Where does it come from?
I couldn't have imagined it for myself either. So hard to say, but I have to say that it was a real blessing for me to come here to a land where I didn't speak the language and didn't have family or friends or feel particularly safe being myself, in that I was able to find solace and peace in the library and among books. So early on, I learned about the power of literacy, of fluency, but also of storytelling and narrative. And that belief has really driven my career and what I do on a day-to-day. But I also have to say that I was just extremely lucky. One can't plan this. Even if you do everything to perfection, it still requires luck. And the fact that my parents were very educated in China, that I was neurotypical and didn't have learning disabilities, all aided me in finding that luck and getting to where I am. And I hope that this trajectory can become more common and more accessible to everyone.
We talk about, you know, in the American West anyway, so many of our undocumented immigrants come from Mexico and Central America. And it's very easy to criticize people coming across the border undocumented. But we all say if we, as parents, had the kind of lives that
many of those people do in Latin America. Their very survivability is threatened. That we would do the same things to bring our children to a better life. Any of us would make that choice. It's very courageous. It's brave. You lived in relative comfort in China before your parents brought you here. Why did they bring you here?
My father grew up being marked as a dissident and thus traitor to China because his oldest brother, the second oldest brother, who was 18 at the time, dared to write a piece criticizing Chairman Mao and the Cultural Revolution, which resulted in millions, possibly, of people being killed under persecution. And because of that marker, my father grew up going to school, being labeled as an outcast, seeing his parents dragged out to public beatings. He was daily humiliated, made to stand up in front of the classroom and be berated by teachers and students alike about his bad family history and how they dared to speak up against the government. He, despite all odds, and I will never know everything that he has gone through because it has been horrific, he became an English literature professor in China, but quickly realized that even in his classroom, even in his newfound position, he could not speak openly and freely about the government. He could not engage in the social criticism that he saw in Dickens and Mark Twain. And so he dreamed of a land where he might one day be able to be open about his critical and intellectual thoughts, and that his daughter would be free to say whatever she believed in. And he feared that something similar would happen to him and thus mark my childhood similarly.
What an incredible story. So your parents came here highly educated. Their jobs, once they got here, were in sweatshops in Chinatown. Can you talk a little bit about how they withstood that?
They are remarkable people. They had to pretty much overnight go from, you know, working at a desk job, speaking in front of a lecture hall, to engaging in menial labor. My mother at sweatshop at a sushi processing plant where she worked for 14 hours at a time, standing in freezing cold water. And I think it was far easier for me as a child to adapt to that change because children are just taking in whatever's immediately before them and just kind of rolling with it. And for my parents, they had to reckon with the psychological effects of going from one extreme to the other. But I would be remiss in talking about this if I did not address that this is part of the resilience of humankind. I think if any of us were placed in that situation where we needed to do what we needed to do to get food on the table, even if it meant making 3 cents per article of clothing, with your young daughter there who's depending on you and looking up to you, you learn that you have to do it and you just do what is in front of you. And I mean, I guess it's fortunate that I saw it early on in my life and understood the resilience and power of the human condition. And some people are not tested in that way early on, so they do not fully embrace how very strong they are. And that's part of the message of my book, is a celebration of the resilience and joys and power of family and of children and of people as they come of age.
Mm. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm speaking with Chen Julie Wang. She's an Ivy League graduate, an attorney, a New York Times and Washington Post op-ed writer. She also grew up undocumented, coming to this country when she was about 7 years old. Talk to us a little bit about how you felt upon arrival. You already said you felt very alone, but you made this huge effort to learn English to begin with and quickly. How did you do it at such a young age?
My first day of school, second grade, I felt like I was walking through a thick fog in my ears before my eyes. I couldn't understand a single thing. And my teacher quickly realized that dealing with me in the mainstream classroom with 35 other children who spoke English fluently was not going to work. So I was sent to a special classroom for students with disabilities, because back then there was no real robust English as a second language program in many public schools. And in that classroom, the teacher was very overwhelmed with many different students of different needs. and I was left alone a lot of the time. And in that time, I found books. There were books on shelves all around me. The very first book I grabbed had little 3D buttons on them with different stars. So you press an apple and it says apple, and you press a star and it says star, and circles and circle. And so slowly working through those buttons, piecing things together, and then graduating to more complex books like Clifford the Big Red Dog and Very Hungry Caterpillar, I pieced together what certain English words are and taught myself over time English before I was returned to the mainstream classroom. But again, I mean, I have to say I was lucky because I was surrounded by some English words in China because my father was an English literature professor. And because I was neurotypical, I was able to work my way through all of this. It was definitely my privilege early in life that helped me get through that particular dark spot. But as I mentioned earlier, it also gave me this profound appreciation and joy of literacy and of literature.
Mm. By many measures, you have achieved the American dream. And yet you say that the American dream is an unattainable idea. And I think many in this country, even those born in this country, are realizing that it is a possibly deteriorating dream. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think so often the American dream is framed as you know, someone coming from the very bottom of social economic class, usually in society, and climbing to the top, which we too often define by material wealth. And I think that's just a damaging concept for our country, because if you are from marginalized communities and you manage to find your way to that upper class defined purely by wealth, at least in my experience, it has been very difficult to be true to myself, to accept who I am and where I came from. And that feeling from my undocumented childhood of having to hide who I was, that I wasn't safe being my full and authentic self, was still carried with me in all those different layers and different rungs. And despite seeming like a success from the outside, I was very much not a success inside. The psychological toll that it takes on people who make this journey and then find themselves still utterly alone in this new world is not something that we should be framing the American dream upon. Rather than drawing this trajectory from bottom to top, I wonder if we might just think about, why is there a bottom class to begin with? Why is it that certain people are relegated to that rung? What can we do to dismantle that hierarchy so that we are truly the America that we market ourselves as, the one that welcomes everyone with open arms, the one that is a refuge for people from across the world?
We have seen in the last 18 months of this pandemic the disparities between the haves and the have-nots growing in huge proportion. And I'm just wondering, what is it like for that? Because you came, as we have talked about, from comfort into poverty in, you know, what many people still call the richest country in the world. What was that like?
It is very, as I mentioned earlier, it's lonely. Mm-hmm. I've had the privilege and the curse of living at every single social economic class, which means I've had to leave people behind when my world's no longer aligned with theirs, when it just becomes too difficult because my problems, rightfully so to many of my people from my past, are not real problems anymore. And I understand that because having lived with those bigger problems of poverty and not feeling safe under the institutions that you live under, my trivial problems of being tired after work and having to walk my dogs are really not problems. But it also makes me feel like I have shadow selves. I walk about my day, I go into my building and I see the woman with her daughter picking through the trash, looking for recyclable cans to deposit for 5 cents a piece. And I see myself there, but I feel that there is a wall and a screen now where I cannot reach out and touch them. And it feels immense, I am very grateful, but also I feel immense guilt. And particularly during this pandemic, I have worried endlessly about how the undocumented children across America are getting fed, how they are getting internet access to go to school, who is with them at home, if anybody. And to think about, you know, me and my little bubble enjoying this, it feels like nothing I do will ever be enough to kind of accord that access that I have been so privileged and lucky to receive.
Why do you think you have been privileged and lucky to receive this? At what point did you rise out of poverty to be able to attend an Ivy League institution?
I think it benefited me greatly, first of all, that my parents were educated before we moved. I had that environment at home where it was drilled into me that education was my way out, literacy was my way out. And then I happened through no, you know, particular merit of my own to learn English without an accent. I think that makes a huge difference. If you are marked with an accent, you have doors shut to you. And I was fortunate enough not to have to worry about that. And then, as I mentioned, there are these elements of not having a disability is the biggest privilege that most of us don't really talk about or think about. And I have been privileged to not even have to worry about that. And so there were many things that positioned me well early in life through luck that allowed me to get this far. And even with those privileges, I cannot believe, and most people cannot believe, of my trajectory. And that should tell you something about the extent of social mobility in our country, unfortunately.
Absolutely. The power of books. You've mentioned that a couple of times in this interview. And you have also mentioned several times, and I find this very interesting, saying that you were neurotypical and that you didn't have some disability, and that was a huge leg up. I mean, I've never really talked to anyone before who has pointed out that this is, being neurotypical is lucky, because it's the default mode, right? It's something we take for granted. Do you think being put in, you know, pull out classes with those who are neurodiverse has given you that different perspective to even bring it up?
Certainly. The other element was reflecting back on my childhood years and how even setting aside the learning environment, I was able to go to bed at night and wake up anew with hope. And that very much has to do with brain chemistry as much as everything else. And now in my work as a civil rights litigator with my firm, I am going back to that schooling environment and seeing how immigrant children are treated, how undocumented immigrant children are treated. And I'm seeing that those who are omitted really out of many considerations are immigrant children with disabilities. They have the most barriers thrown in front of them. And that was something, to be frank, I never even thought of for many years because I had that privilege. And privilege is what you don't think about. And so I am learning anew the many ways in which this impossible to navigate system is made all the more impossible when you come into the world with a certain set of disadvantages.
During the pandemic, the plight of the undocumented has become blaringly obvious, I believe, to many people who may not have thought about it before. Many would say that there's an entire economy around undocumented people who are actually paying into the system, but will never reap any of the benefits from it. So in other words, whether they're falsely documented or whatever it is, they're paying their taxes, their fair share of taxes, they will never reap unemployment or any of the benefits that many, many people have been getting for the last 18 months and getting in general. What do you think about that whole economy in terms of how it's keeping us from having immigration reform and arriving at a solution? Because many would say that there's a desire to keep that economy going where many people are paying in but not taking back from the system.
For sure. And it manifests itself in different ways. The other instance, and you paint a great one, but the other instance is these types of jobs that are paid under the table with really unworkable conditions that no one who is documented is willing to take, and only those desperate enough to get a paying job without documents will perform. And those are vital services in vital industries. As we've seen in the pandemic, there are only a subset of us who are willing to go outside and expose our bodies and our health because we need to put food on the table. And there's definitely a desire, I think, and a natural momentum in our capitalist structure to keep that in place. And I just, for those in the upper class who believe that that is helpful, I wonder if people think about the humanity behind the person who's waiting on you and the person who's delivering your food, and whether they feel like living in a world like that, eating the food from someone who is living under such desperation is good for them, and whether that leads to a stable society in which they can feel comfortable in their wealth and safe in their wealth. Because I don't think, I mean, even speaking from a purely selfish perspective, you don't want that person at the very least to spit in your food, much less, you know, to be buying into the structure that naturally oppresses people by definition of who they are and how they came to this country.
Chen Julie Wang, her new book is about being undocumented in America. It's called Beautiful Country. And it debuts on the New York Times bestseller list. I'm so pleased you could join me on The Mountain Life, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care, Lynn.
And that was Chen Julie Wang and her memoir, Beautiful Country. It's a lovely story.
Our next guest, Lauren Lockie, has an animal sanctuary located 10 miles from Park City, Utah. Sage Mountain provides education about the farmed animals residing at their sanctuary, coupled with advocacy and community outreach. Their objective is to inspire others to lifestyle changes, advocate for farm animals, and build a caring and open community dialogue and yoga. We're excited to have Lauren on the show. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And this is a relatively new venture. Give us a little bit of backstory to how you started Animal Sanctuary and this just 10 miles from Park City.
Yeah, so Sage Mountain has been around since about 2013, which is when we established the nonprofit. And right now we have a little over 20, I think we have 27, 28 rescued farm animals out there at the sanctuary. And we started out with two pigs. And the reason we got into it is because we saw the effects of animal agriculture on our planet, on our resources, and obviously the animals themselves that are so entrenched in our food system, and also on our own health. And so we decided, hey, why not create this space that we can rescue some animals that have all been through a lot and within the food system, and then create even more through that of a community and being, you know, being in their presence, and how that has become super healing, not only for the animals but also for the people that come out there and volunteer, the people that come out there and visit, the people that come to our yoga classes. And just through that, it has built more momentum, and people are starting to realize the impact they have through their food choices and product choices. And especially when you come face to face with a pig or a steer or a turkey that you normally wouldn't come face to face with, and how that has been really eye-opening for many people.
Well, I think many of our listeners are familiar with animal rescue when we think of dogs and cats. And I hate to kind of go back on this, but what does it entail? You know, what's the process? What are the conditions typically that a farm animal would face that would require or facilitate a farm animal rescue? And how do you go about acquiring that? You know, I used to steal animals from farms, but that wouldn't be called rescuing.
Right.
Yes. That's just theft.
That's just well, yes. So we work with other different organizations. So for instance, our first two pigs came from Farm Sanctuary. So Farm Sanctuary is located in, they have a few different sanctuaries, but one is in California. They have one in New York. And so we were contacted because Pony Boy, who is one of our pigs, was found as a baby. and he had escaped a large pig farm. So a large pig farm entails pigs being confined in very small spaces, usually concrete. A lot of the females, the sows, are kept in gestation crates, which they can't even turn around. And when they have babies, they still can't turn around. They can only lie there. And a lot of times they crush their own babies just through that process. When these animals are born, their tails are docked off without any painkillers, because they are kept in such close confined spaces that they go crazy. Anyone would. You know, imagine that you can't move from a plane seat. You know, we think a long trip is really hard. Imagine that being your entire life, where you can't even get up. And these are, you know, beyond any intelligence. You know, obviously pigs are in the top five as far as intelligent species. But beyond that, like, these are sentient beings that feel pain, that want to be happy, that want to be free. And so that's one example of where one of our pigs came from. Another pig we have named Morgan fell off a transport truck. So he was only 3 months old. And you see these trucks on the road, right? We see them all the time, these big semis, and we can look into the slits and see these animals in there. And we know usually, okay, we know where they're going, but we don't really connect to that aspect of that. How these animals are treated in our food system. So luckily, Morgan jumped or fell off, I think, through that back door, and was found in Morgan County, and very, very scraped up, very cut up. But at 3 months old, he was going to what's called a finishing barn, right, where these pigs go and they get fattened up for about 3 months before they go to slaughter. So that's another instance. We have a few steers and goats that came from a similar program, like a 4-H program, where these kids are connected to these animals and they learn to really care for these creatures as their friends. And then usually at the end of this process, whether it's 6 months to a year, you know, we're teaching our kids to basically, like, betray, you know, these animals and our friends that we have taken such good care of. So a lot of kids will reach out or ask their parents, like, I don't want to see my friend go to auction or go to slaughter. Can we do something else? Can we make sure that this animal has a safe place to live? So all of our goats came from that situation, and a few of our steers as well.
We're speaking with Lauren Locke of Sage Animal Sanctuary. Well, let's move in. These stories are so compelling, and I feel like I could talk to you all day about the animals. And I just love Pony Boy, that he escaped. You know, it tells you something about the intelligence. But we have to move into this other part, which is so interesting, how you connect an animal sanctuary with healing for, you know, us humans. Mm-hmm. And you are a beloved yoga instructor around town. You've been doing it for over several decades, and your classes are very popular. You're an excellent instructor. You make me love yoga, which, you know, it's kind of hard to do. And so you tell us how you combine the two.
Yes. So what I started noticing, and just through my own life, and I think we all can relate, that growing up with pets in our homes, our dogs, our cats, brought so much joy in our lives. And me growing up, I was kind of a loner, but I found solace in being around the animals, and being around horses, and being around my dog, and being around my cat, and being able to be myself and be vulnerable in that. And I've realized through these last many, many years how that hasn't changed for me. And I think it hasn't changed for many of us. You know, we can be ourselves around our dog. We can, like, sing songs and dance around and feel comfortable doing that. And the animals and our pets are always happy to see us, no matter what, you know. And I think there's a lot that we can gain from that. And that sense of letting go, and that sense of forgiveness, that sense of finding joy in the present moment. And so through this pandemic, I noticed that so many people were craving that connection and wanted to be around animals. And yes, farm animals we don't think of as our dogs and cats as much, but when you are around them, they are very similar. They bring that same innocence and that same kindness and compassion that we find through our pets at home. And the only reason that we may not connect to that is because we're not around them every day in our homes. So what I started noticing is people coming out and being able to find joy and let go and find that present moment around these pigs and sheep and goats. And the goats are very happy to see you when they come out, when you come out there. And so that's why I brought this into my Lauren Locke Wellness, the coaching, which is very new. I just started it and I'm super excited about it. And that piece of it, along with acts of service and giving back, how that can be really, really fulfilling in our lives, or when we give and when we can give from a place of kindness and joy and from our hearts, how that is really a big answer and one of the main answers to sustaining happiness in our lives.
So sagemountain.org, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And you have this on the homepage. I can't pull it up now for some reason, but you have a wonderful photo of, is it Pony Boy?
Yes.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. Is Lauren Locke Wellness also on that site so we can find out what it's all about? Or, okay.
No.
No.
So, LaurenLockeWellness.com is separate. So that's a whole separate website. So there's sagemountain.org, and then there's LaurenLockeWellness.com. And you can, but on my website, you can find out more about Sage Mountain. So it's kind of, they're both separate, but also
very, connected.
Very much connected. Yes.
Oh, I love it. So what does Lauren Locke Wellness consist of? We have the animals, we have the yoga. What else?
Yes. Yeah, so basically the arms of my coaching are nutrition, physical fitness and movement, incorporating healthy habits into our daily lives, which is very, very important, whether that's meditation, whether that is moving your body every day, whether that's writing, whether that's creating a schedule of, you know, better sleep and how to incorporate that into your daily life. And then the two others that I think kind of separate me from some other coaching is the acts of service. So giving back, finding what you're passionate about, finding that what resides in your heart that you feel strongly about, that you want to give to, and giving to the greater good, and how that is so fulfilling in our lives. And then the animal therapy part is obviously a big aspect as well. So a lot of my sessions take place out there.
That's a super rewarding career. And I imagine not only just what you've learned, but watching others who've been able to join you in this journey has been, you know, inspiring. Are you seeing, you know, that this impact on others currently? Like, you have a huge following that you're, you know, having to like hold them back at the doors of the farm.
Well, a lot of people do come out to the sanctuary, and we're not having to close our doors or like push people away at all. In fact, it's when we have, you know, our group volunteer days are anywhere from, you know, 10 to 20 people, and those are on Saturdays, 10 to noon. So please sign up for those and come out. It's gaining momentum for sure. And especially, like I said, this year with the pandemic, and I think people craving that connection and just wanting connection, it has built up a lot more, along with, you know, we're having more events out there. We had a plant-based palooza out there. We had music, and we did an auction to sponsor our animals, and every single animal is sponsored, and that's just like amazing. And just through this process, when we first started to now, and all the people that have come on board to help, whether it's volunteers, whether it's our few employees that we have, it's just been so amazing, and I'm so grateful for that, for our community as well.
And do you anticipate people, after hearing this wonderful interview, that they're going to say, hey, I'm just going to do a drive-by, drop off my kids and let them run around your farm? Is that acceptable, or should we actually go onto your website and reserve yes. heads up notice for you.
Yes, please do that. Please go on our website and reserve.
Because you'll see me, and I'm probably going to do a drive-by, let my kids out of the car and just keep going.
Just, no, and then just like, kidding, keep just going. Yeah. Here you go.
Steal some farm animals. Like,
well, I'll steal them back, right? Hang out in my backyard. So, well, is there a possibility of a adoption? You know, you think of foster programs at Nuzzles or so forth. Can we foster a farm animal in our backyard?
We don't offer that. Originally, when we first started, we talked about doing that, and then we just decided that this will be a sanctuary, and the kids, they are kids. Yeah. They get to just reside and be there for their entire lives. Yeah, right.
And talk to your HOA before you do steal one of their yes. animals. And yeah. stealing is bad. So,
hey, well, Lauren, before you go, I just have to ask you, LaurenLockeyWellness.com. is a beautiful website. I couldn't get it up for some reason on my computer. I have all these filters. Oh. But on my phone here, who did your photography? I mean, these photos of you doing yoga are absolutely incredible.
Thank you. Johnny Nunez, he is an amazing photographer, and I highly recommend him for any sort of events, anything out of the sanctuary. He takes the photos. He's a great friend of mine, and he's amazing. So Johnny Nunez is his name.
Great job on the website. Okay, Lauren Locke.
Super exciting, and I look forward to seeing you at the sanctuary and learning how to, you know, improve mine and others' lives as we do that. So
thank you so much for having me.
Hey, Lauren, just to facilitate Pete's drive-by. I know I'm ashamed that I've never been out there.
You
but
haven't.
I know it's in Browns Canyon.
Yes.
Tell us kind of about where.
Okay.
Which
so,
side of the road.
Right. So Browns Canyon, you know, you would go left on Browns Canyon. We're about 3.5 miles down on the right. We don't advertise from the road only because don't want people dropping off animals
or children.
Their children or anything like that. So, but that's about where before you would get to Nuzzles, the Nuzzles farm out that we're on the right.
What a great experience. If I was road biking Browns Canyon and I wanted to take a break, instead of getting a latte, just pet and connect with a farm animal.
You have to go up a big road to get up there. So it adds here.
You're killing some of these ideas, Lauren.
Are you near Zaphod? Sounds like you're next door.
We're a little further down.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. It's
Thank
been
you.
Great talking. We got to wrap up this interview. We could talk to you for the rest of the hour, but
I would love to be here.
We have another gentleman to speak with. So thanks for joining us. It's great to see you in studio.
Yes, yeah. Good to see you too. Thanks so much.
My guest this morning is Bill Eddy. He's an expert on managing disputes involving people with high conflict personalities. And to a certain degree, in the last few years, there has been a preponderance of high conflict personalities. In fact, many of us have probably noticed ourselves being high conflict. You know, masks versus no masks, vaxxers versus anti-vaxxers, conservative versus liberal. We all just have to be right. Bill Eddy is the co-founder of the High Conflict Institute. He's a senior family mediator, a certified family law specialist, and a licensed clinical social worker and therapist. And he's written a new book, Calming Upset People with EAR, or EAR, How Statements Showing Empathy, Attention, and Respect Can Quickly Diffuse a Conflict. Bill Eddy, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much, Lynn. I'm glad to be on.
We have talked a lot recently about empathy. And yet, I was thinking about it this morning and thinking that it's really almost a point of argument to not show empathy. Because if we show empathy, then it might be that other person could possibly be a little bit right. And we don't want that. I mean, this is what I feel recently, as I was talking about in our intro, how we all just have to be right. What's up with that?
Well, I think there's two sides to human nature. And one is the fighting, negative, maybe survival side. And that tells us we have to win, otherwise we'll lose. And so a discussion of something, one of the topics you just mentioned and many other topics, turns into an effort to win the discussion by both people. And in the process, when you're in a win-lose situation, especially if you feel your survival's at stake, it's real easy to turn off your empathy and see the other as an enemy. And you can't give an inch to an enemy or they'll run right over you, or that's how it feels. But the reality is, we're on the same team. And when you're on the same team, it really helps to have empathy for each other, and you can have disagreements. And so I think what's happened over the last few years is we've started to feel like we're on two different teams and it's us against them. And part of ear statements, which is the technique, the simple technique I talk about in the book, is that ear statements reinforce we're on the same team even though we disagree. And in fact, I even include a confrontation between someone who's wearing a mask and someone who isn't wearing a mask and doesn't intend to. And the idea is we're not on two different teams. It isn't win-lose, and it isn't a fight for survival. It just feels that way. And an easy way to overcome that is to give the other person an ear statement, something that shows empathy, like, I feel that way too sometimes, or I can understand your frustration, or I see how hard this is, or I hear the difficulty in this situation. None of those gives up anything. You haven't lost a thing to give the other person some empathy. And I think that's the key to resolving some of today's conflicts, because the other side of us is we have to work together to accomplish anything.
So is that then how we are on the same team? Because it doesn't feel very often like we are on the same team when we feel so passionately and the other person feels so passionately on the polar opposite.
Yeah, well, what we have to watch out for is feelings and problem solving, because feelings can come a lot from absorbing other people's hostility, other people's anger, hurt, fear, etc. And emotions are contagious. And that's actually, I start out explaining that in the book. If someone's angry with you, it automatically hooks your amygdala and your mirror neurons get ready to do the exact same thing. And now you're both angry at each other. But we're not slaves to our feelings. Our feelings are part of us, but we also have the ability to think. You know, the amygdala in the middle of the brain can be overridden by the prefrontal cortex. And that's the part that develops during adolescence and really tells you this isn't a crisis, this is a problem to solve. And so we've shifted from disagreements with each other, from them being problems to solve, to being crises, a lot just because of the nature of today's society. We're dealing with a lot of people we don't know. Our sense of family and community is weaker. We're kind of looking for how can we feel connected. And a lot of today, you feel connected by your beliefs, by your religion, your politics, your you know, heated opinions. And with social media and all the commenting, we've trained ourselves to dislike each other and argue with each other when we used to chat with our neighbor. And we used to, you know, have more kids in the house, and we all had kids. We've got to get along. But we've kind of grown up in a world where it almost feels like to get along with a few people, you have to hate a lot of other people.
So true. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, my guest is Bill Eddy. He has written a new book called Calming Upset People with EAR, How Statements Showing Empathy, Attention, and Respect Can Quickly Diffuse a Conflict. As you were talking, Bill, I thought about you know, over the years, the things that I don't feel extremely passionate about, but I have maybe a belief about, and I encounter someone who seems to have a different belief. And it's very easy to do all these things, but I think that you're correct in saying that social media has turned us against each other, has created much more passionate people, but passion in just the wrong sense of the word. Passion's supposed to be this positive thing. But really, you know, I would say between social media and the pundits on cable TV, it really has created passion in the wrong sense of the word. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, I think the passion comes from very much from all forms of media, in that to get attention today on the media, you have to have a lot of emotion in it. And you're totally right. The pundits on cable, even the mainstream evening news, to get your attention, it's got to be emotional. I think about with the TVs on, every, you know, like four times a day, you hear a police siren on the TV. Well, why are they playing a police siren? Because it grabs your attention. It grabs your amygdala and says, there's trouble afoot, you know. And so our passion is really being absorbed from all of these forms of media trying to grab our attention, because you're not going to get attention if you just, you know, talk about technical things, you know, how to rewire your electrical system. You don't get a lot of people watching that. But so there's this emotional grab to try to get us going. But the other thing is, you'll find most of the people you're disagreeing with are at a distance. And so on social media, the pundits on TV, et cetera, you don't know them. You can yell at the TV and nobody gets hurt. If you yell at your neighbor, you're running a risk of them, you know, wanting to mow your lawn in a new direction or something. And so what's fascinating, and I mentioned near the end of the book, was there was a couple different projects to bring people of different opinions together for a weekend. And there was one, it was 500 people with different political opinions representing the whole United States. And what they did is they had them talk one-to-one and in small groups. And the outcome of that was people's opinions softened. They weren't as extreme. They weren't us versus them. They were more of a reasonable disagreement between people who were friends, like neighbors and such. And they found some people formed a really nice connection and liked each other, even though they had opposite points of view, because the opposite points of view weren't that extreme. Another project took a group of Jewish people in a synagogue in New York City, and a group of liberal, and a group of conservative prison guards in Michigan. And they had each group, I think it was like a dozen people, spend a weekend with the other group. They stayed in each other's homes. They toured the area where they live. They cooked for each other. And they were just shocked at how they liked the other people and they were reasonable, even though they held different opinions. I don't think anyone stopped being a liberal or conservative, but they liked each other. And that was the key. So one-to-one, we get along because there's a real person there. So part of today's problem is we're dealing with so many people at a distance we don't know, and it's much easier to hate people like that.
It's so unfortunate, but I love what you're saying. Well, you talked a little bit about, you know, those phrases we might use to show empathy. You know, I know how you're feeling. I feel that way sometimes too. You know, let's just take, because it's so current, the vaccine versus anti-vaxxing. Both sides are motivated in some part by fear.
Yes.
Fear of the unknown, fear of what they think they know. And I guess I love the statements, the the empathy statements, but sometimes you attempt that and you really don't feel it at all. You're just saying this thing that's kind, you're kind of faking it. Help me out there.
And to hear Bill Eddy's response, you can tune in to kpcw.org, our new website. You'll find those three little lines in the upper left-hand corner. Find The Mountain Life, and you can hear the rest of that conversation with Bill Eddy. You've been listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. And you can also find our podcasted show on anywhere you get your podcast, KPCW, The Mountain Life. Thanks for tuning in today, and thanks to all our guests for joining us.